Welcome, everybody, to the International Conference of Secular AA Virtual 2021. We're so glad you can join us. This conference has been a whirlwind to put on as a replacement for what we'd hoped was going to be an in-person conference in Washington, D.C., as we've done every 2 years pre-pandemic. This, however, is probably going to be the future of recovery, along with face-to-face returning. And the committee here is can assure you that wherever you live in the world, we will be continuing to be offering Zoom content just like this. I look forward to next year sitting in the back with my feet up as a demanding participant and enjoying the content that's available. But it's been a pleasure to serve, and there a lot of hard work has been by people you don't even know so much. I get a lot of accolades, but there have been so many people, that's just misdirection, who have been, it wouldn't have happened without them. We are offering simultaneous translation for the first time ever. So if you're just coming in, if you want to listen in Spanish, choose Spanish and also choose mute original audio. It'll make the listening experience easier for you. And if you are English, if you want to hear questions, while the content in this meeting won't be in Spanish, if you want to hear questions coming to us in translated, have English on and mute original audio. This is a completely free event, but there are expenses with running a conference, and we have them too. And we will be posting a chat just if you wish to contribute to secular AA, and we would appreciate any help we get. But we're glad you're here. That's the main shot of everything. And if you have questions as you go, we will leave the chat open. If you're trying to chat to somebody else and you can't, it's because we're quietly fighting off Zoom bombers in the background, which can happen, and our co-hosts will work at eliminating or any disturbance. You will always be able to communicate with hosts or co-hosts, so feel free. And more information will be provided throughout the day. And thank you, everybody, for being here. I'm going to turn it over to Karen from London, UK, and she's going to introduce our speakers. Sit back and enjoy, everybody. It's going to be great.
Thanks, Joe. Hi, everybody. I'm Karen. I'm from London, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the International Conference of Secular AA, ICSA 2021. And this session is the Doctor's Opinion 2021 with the two Dr. Pauls, Addiction and Recovery Today. So I've been sober since 2013, so just celebrated 8 years without a drink. Yeah, mainly in secular AA, did some traditional AA, but, you know, it's all AA to me. And here we are in Zoom AA. And much of the worldwide agnostic atheist freethinker community of AA will be here for the next 10 hours of programming. And we're secular by format, but let me assure you that everybody is welcome. In secular AA, we want everyone who thinks that they may have a problem with alcohol to realize that sobriety is possible regardless of what you do or do not believe. Recovery in AA comes without having to accept anyone else's beliefs nor having to deny your own. Our first speaker, Dr. Paul F., has worked as a physician in the field of addiction medicine and occupational medicine for more than 25 years. His interest in addiction medicine has morphed over those years into a greater curiosity related to addiction, recovery, science, and treatment. Dr. Paul has consulted with employers and unions and assisted in developing and delivering recovery-oriented programs.
Thanks for assist employees. Pausing, but I'm on mute.
Minimize disability associated with addiction and other complex medical conditions. So far, Dr. Paul F. has provided independent medical assessment and treatment recommendations for thousands of individuals with addictive disorders, especially those involved in safety-sensitive work. Dr. Paul S. is a full-time addiction medicine physician with a focus on occupational and recovery medicine. Dr. Paul is past president of the Canadian Society of Addiction Medicine, received a certificate of added competence in addiction medicine from the College of Family Physicians of Canada in 2019, and certification from the American Board of Addiction Medicine in 2010. Dr. Paul is clinical instructor with the UBC Faculty of Medicine Department of Family Practice and adjunct professor at Simon Fraser University. The former lead physician of the Royal Columbian Hospital Addiction Medicine Service and acts as an occupational addiction medicine consultant to both public and private organisations. Dr. Paul worked extensively in both harm reduction and in abstinence-based care models and is the former regional divisional lead for addictions in the Fraser Health Authority and the former chair of the BC College of Physicians and Surgeons Methadone Maintenance Committee. Now I'd like to hand over to Dr. Paul F., who will present for around 20 minutes, followed by Dr. Paul S., who will follow for another 20 minutes, after which we will take time for some Q&A or comments. Thank you. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for the Karen and Joe. That was a great introduction, Karen. My mother would have been very proud. But basically, I'm Paul. I'm in long-term recovery. I'm pleased to be here with you today. I'm on the west coast of BC. Actually, I acknowledge I'm currently on the traditional and ancestral lands of the Coast Salish people here, the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam Nations. So it is quite a great to get the invite and quite a flattering title, you know, the doctor's opinion. I don't think Paul and myself, who are friends and colleagues in the same and live in the same part of the world, we have anything as profound as the doctor's opinion, but we do have, I guess, some thoughts that would probably lead us to be considered to think a bit differently to many of our other colleagues. So we probably agree on more than we would ever disagree on, but we'd like to share that with you today. To put some context on this session, we both, yes, work as addiction medicine physicians. We have consulting practices. We see the impact of addiction on individuals and families and the medical complications and work and disability and all those huge costs. And we are certainly very interested in addiction medicine. We are, as you will hear, particularly interested in the concepts of recovery and recovery medicine. And you'll hear terms some of you may be familiar with, but important terms for us is recovery and recovery capital and recovery orientated systems of care. So we hope that we'll flesh out some of our thoughts on that. We have also been asked, you know, we're two people who obviously work in the Canadian healthcare system, but also may end up looking for care in the Canadian healthcare system. My personal recovery journey has gained a lot more outside of the traditional medical system than ever inside the medical system. So I think we'll talk a little bit about that. But Joe had asked us if we would comment on some of the challenges, barriers, thoughts about individuals who want to disclose to their personal physician or how some of those interactions, you know, might be optimized. And that's a difficult topic, but we'll add a few things on that. A couple of very important things to note. We want to emphasize that and we stress and underscore that nothing that we say here today should be considered to be medical advice or directed or for anybody, any attending. Also, although this is not a formal medical presentation, we're usually advised to clarify if there's any conflict of interest that we might have. So we should state, and we do state, that neither of us have any involvement in treatment centers or affiliations with treatment providers or monitoring companies or laboratories or pharmaceutical companies or anything that would put us in a conflict of interest. And we know a full financial association with the ICSAA. Our intention is actually, Karen, to do a bit of tagging back and forward on some of the highlights that we ended up discussing with Joe. We'll spend most time on that. So, you know, as a background, I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but, you know, basically I was born and raised in Ireland and medical school there. And you know, one of my geographical cures was to Canada in 1986, and I'm still here. You know, good upbringing. Lots of love, no major traumas. My father was a non-drinker. worked with Guinness Brewery, and he didn't drink because my paternal grandfather was alcoholic, and most of what I knew of him was as a dry drunk phase of his life. So I don't have a big drunk log to tell you, but just basically, like many people here, you know, I enjoyed trying to be a really good partier and a really good control drinker. And I tried that research on many, many occasions, and occasionally got it right and often got it wrong. And eventually it became a reality that things were unmanageable and I needed to make some kind of a shift towards long-term sobriety. And I made that decision several times, but it kind of stuck in 2009, and I'm here today. So I'd like to pass it over to Paul, who tell you a bit about his story. And also the interesting topic of, I think, where addiction and Western medicine and the interactions and where we are at and how we got here today. So, Paul, can you take it over?
Thank you very much. I'm a guy in long-term recovery. A bit about my background. I was first exposed, opiates really are my drug of choice, and I was first exposed when I was about 4 years old, and that was really an epiphanal experience in my life. Next exposed around age 12, and I knew that was the place to go, and got me into significant trouble, especially when I was a practicing physician. And when I was age 20, or when I was age 30, I had an experience, and it was really an epiphany that occurred on that day. In May of 1993, I experienced a miracle of recovery, and I was exposed to good people in recovery. I was welcomed into a community of recovery. And since that time, I've been able to maintain recovery. And it, as a family doctor at the time, I decided to pursue a career in addiction medicine and went to the United States and did some formal training when I was about 6 years sober. Then, you know, have worked broadly in addiction medicine since that time. But I'm really interested, like Paul is, in recovery medicine. There's medicine, but there's recovery medicine, which I find much more interesting because it's really an antithesis to the Western model of medicine. And I'll just briefly talk about that. There's some theories of addiction medicine and that have moved toward the medicalization of addiction medicine. And it's interesting. I always found this interesting where early in the course of AA, it talked about there being an allergy to alcohol. And I thought that that's a piece of the addiction model, but it wasn't the first. I mean, this was articulated long in the past with various different authors into antiquity, but it was one of the first kind of modern emphasis on, allergy and there being a something the matter with the individual's brain that caused the behavior in the relationship with alcohol. Well, that got better articulated in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychiatry with dependence and abuse. And it really defined dependence as a disease concept, and you had to meet these criteria, and abuse was more of a social issue. Neuroimaging really pushed that whole attitude of addiction being a brain disease along. Alan Leshner, Nora Volkow, the former and current heads of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, do 80% of all neuroimaging. And it strongly reinforced this orientation toward the brain being the source of addiction in individuals. And it pushed along this drive model, right? You know, people use substances in order to experience something. And I thought about that. And to me, there was something the matter with that because I used substance to experience that drive, but only for a couple of years. And then after that, I just couldn't not use substances. It was a lack of inhibition. I couldn't not engage in those behaviors. Alarm went in the morning. I got up about 10 minutes before it went, and I was on it. So then a speaker last year, George Kube, who we also had talked at our national conference a few months ago, started talking about hyperkatephia. And I think that this is moving the discussion and the narrative along from drive to there's a problem with inhibition here. You know, people with this problem have a lot of difficulties inhibiting. So addiction doesn't have a single causative factor. And we, you know, we tend to be reductionists because there's just a lot of information and we're looking for that easier, softer way, that magic bullet. And there's a lot of causative factors. There's a lot of risk factors, but it's not just neurochemistry. It's not just the brain. It's not just trauma. It's not just other risk factors. It's generally a culmination of those risk factors. But what has happened in my view is there's been a pharmacological revolution. Pharmaceutical agents have played a very significant role in the treatment of addiction. But I look at this personally and I say, well, when was the last, health protection branch in Canada or FDA in the United States approved medication for addiction? And it was naltrexone. And we're talking like more than 25 years ago. So the pharmacological revolution hasn't really borne a lot of fruit. There's a lot of talk, but there's not really high quality evidence for a pharmacological agent that has borne fruit. I get older and I become more of a skeptic. And it says to me, and I've seen this in my practice, that this focus on pharmacological agents has to some degree reduced the agency of the individual. I've come to the conclusion that the most modifiable endpoints aren't really neurological. They're not in my brain. The most modifiable endpoints are social. So I'm gonna hand it back over to Paul to talk a little bit about journey of understanding.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah. I wanted to talk a bit about journey of understanding would be a good way of putting it. I mean, I've worked in addiction medicine for quite a long time, and still traditional medicine, it's still kind of stuck in that acute. Episodic, that acute care Western traditional medical model of intervening or treatment, and that's dominated the landscape. So how that translates into my work is, somebody phones my office about their kid or their worker or their whatever, and they're assuming that I'm going to magically pick some like super stellar rehab focused experience for this individual, and that they'll go to some place and they'll have this treatment delivered in a short period of time, often linked to how long insurance will pay for it. And then afterwards, there's basically no integration or coordination of anything afterwards. And, there's kind of seven key elements I see in this model that is so programmatically driven over the years. And that is like there's some screening and finding the individual, then there's an admission process, and there's kind of a single point of a month or something of assessment and treatment, and that short course is minimally individualized for that person. Then they're discharged. There may or may not be brief aftercare of some kind of nature, and then there's a termination of the service relationship. And it's interesting because most of that is kind of expert driven, who direct and kind of dominate the assessment process and dominate the whole thing, actually. And, many of us have been at these graduation ceremonies, and cure has occurred. After that, of course, the reality is we send people out on this precarious knife edge between, early recovery and early relapse. The reality is that long-term abstinence or what seems to happen is long-term abstinence or sobriety is viewed on as a personally sustainable something that you can achieve without any special assistance. And it's a pretty tricky time. And then we have post-treatment relapse or readmission, and it's judged to be a flaw or a fault of the individual rather than any of the process we put in place. So, Paul and I have lots of discussion and debates on lots of things, and we argue and talk about a lot of things. But this is one of the things I think that frustrates both of us is this kind of approach that this one-off spin people through the cycle, and it's all going to work out fine. And in medicine, maybe in rooms we might talk about clean and sober, but in medicine, people write or talk about any kind of improvement in one situation as remission. Or sobriety. So remission we use a lot in medicine as, remission from cancer and so forth. So people talk about remission. But I think what we would both agree is that tends to focus on a removal of some negative problems from a person's life. And often all that happens is they no longer maybe meet the the diagnostic criteria for the condition. But we're much more interested in the term recovery, which is speaking about in addition to remission, it's a broader achievement of overall health at several levels. And certainly that's what's important for me. It's not important for me just to stay sober. I'm working on my recovery. How I consider remission is it tends to emphasize what's been removed from the person's life, often negative. And I think of recovery of what's been added. And it's a strength-based concept. Now, there are an unknown and very large number of people who would describe themselves as living in recovery out there, and they have a newer, sober, and productive lifestyle. And when you ask people, they'll commonly say something like, what it means to me is I'm abstinent, I don't want to use drugs or alcohol anymore, and I'm taking steps in my life to ensure that that won't happen again. And I think there's a general realization that abstinence, if that has occurred, is unlikely to be maintained without this other broader concept of recovery and recovery activities and recovery communities and so forth. So needless to say, there's in medicine or in anywhere, you get lots of debate over what is recovery. Sometimes there can be as much argument over the definition of recovery as, you know, at a business meeting, should we buy the sugar in cubes or in small packages? But recovery that people use, and you might see whether any of them resonate for you. So one is the Canadian Society of, it's the Canadian Center for Substance Abuse, defines recovery as abstinence, improved health, social connections and functioning, and enhanced quality of life. So abstinence is in their definition. The Betty Ford Institute, a voluntarily maintained lifestyle that is characterized by sobriety, personal health, and citizenship. The American Society of Addiction Medicine, I know there are a lot of US colleagues on here, a process of sustained action that addresses the biological, psychological, social, and spiritual disturbances that are inherent in addiction, while addressing an individual's consistent pursuit of abstinence. And it's not saying it's achieved, it's a consistent pursuit of abstinence, impairment in behavioral control and dealing with cravings. And finally, an author that Paul and I have become very fond of and read a lot of, many of you will be familiar with the writings of William White. And he said, recovery is the experience through which individuals, families, communities are impacted, and they utilize internal and external resources to voluntarily resolve these problems, heal the wound inflicted by alcohol and drug and alcohol problems, actively manage their continued vulnerability to such problems, and develop a healthy, productive, and meaningful life. So I don't want to get, you know, over drilling down into all the words, but recovery is important. It would be great if we get a one-off definition, but I'm not locked into one definition. What's more important for me is that there seem to be common threads woven through most of these attempts at definitions that are very relevant and important to me, and very relevant and important for the people I see in my office. And they include the following, which, you note again, is recovery focused, it's strength based. And they talk, the key themes seem to be an abstinence or pursuit of abstinence from addictive behavior, an improvement in mental health and physical health, improved level of psychosocial spiritual functioning, a reduction in antisocial behavior, and an increased contribution to society. So I'm more interested in that. And certainly I think William White's definition, you know, tries to get in some ways to some of that, but it leads to the concept that White talks about, which is recovery capital. And I think Paul is going to talk to us just a little bit about what is recovery capital, and what are some of the important issues in there that would be important for us to consider. The mute thing, Paul?
I was saying I live on the wet coast, and there's a bit of an epiphany occurring here. As you may see, the sun is shining. And this occurs very rarely out here between about, let's call it September and May. So this is a good day. Paul talked a little bit about the difference in the Western models, you know, remission being designed as absence of symptoms, but it doesn't really confer wellness. You know, the person just doesn't have symptoms anymore. But when I'm treating two people that are addicted to fentanyl and they're both in remission, I don't know how to determine which person is going to experience a fatal or non-fatal overdose the next day. I don't. There's no prognostic factor attached to that DSM view. And so Paul then talked about, you know, recovery and recovery capital. And recovery capital is this concept that it's not really new. You know, it's just that it's being codified by a number of writers, as Paul mentioned, William White, John Kelly, David Best, et cetera. It's been codified into what it looks like. And what recovery capital is it's really identifying what the individual's strengths are. Okay, so if I'm involved with an individual, I'm treating the individual, and I make a diagnosis, yeah, you got all these problems occurring in your life, you got the disease. There's no doubt about that. We have some evidence-based treatment to offer you. And I give that individual the evidence-based treatment, and it may work, it may not work, but I don't know why it didn't work. So then if I assess the individual's recovery capital, and it's from the point of view of what is their social capital, i.e., I objectively look at their supports. Who do they get supports from? Who do they hold obligations and commitments to? Their physical capital, which allows movement and access to treatment. Their human capital, such as their educational level and intelligence, and cultural capital, their ability to fit into a dominant social behavior. So if I can objectively assess this individual's recovery capital, it tells me what they can recruit to get better. And it tells me who will not respond, much more likely who will not respond to the Western model's evidence-based interventions. And so this is what I find really exciting in medicine is now I'm not just using interventions to get rid of signs and symptoms and to get rid of evidence of disease anymore. I'm using interventions to assist the individual identifying how they can become well. So the Western model views addiction as a chronic relapsing disease. When I initially treat a patient, the first thing that I'm thinking about is how can I offer this person an intervention that they get what I got? They've got long-term remission and evidence of recovery on the first try. And what I do is I look at what kind of strengths they have. And I can do one of two things. I can either assist them in using the strengths they have, recruit those strengths to address their deficits, or I can offer novel interventions to assist in addressing where they don't have strengths. And that's the recovery capital approach. So it speaks much more to recovery, like Paul said, in that it's mental and physical health. It's not just absence of disease, it's mental and physical health. Pro-social behavior. I'm not just a member of a recovering community. I'm an active member of a recovering community. Work. This idea of CHIME, the acronym of CHIME, where feel connection. H, hope. I, identity. M, meaning. And then lastly, employment is the one I like to use. And in my own personal recovery, I experience agency. So I'm the person that's making the decisions on a day-to-day basis around my recovery and my life. And eventually what it results in is a concept of emancipation where there's nobody involved from a treatment standpoint in my recovery anymore. Everybody that assists me in a recruiting recovery capital, that assists me individually achieving, maintaining, and growing my recovery, all exists on the same plane. Okay? There's no power imbalance. So recovery isn't just AA or mutual support group meetings, although important elements exist within mutual support group meetings, such as this one, that support recovery. And it's interesting that when you look at the life and recovery surveys that have been done in four different countries that are surveying individuals who are in recovery, mutual support meetings play the most substantial role in the individuals achieving what they defined as recovery. That was the key factor. And more than 50% of people achieved it on first try. Very few people had a medical model intervention. Paul?
If it sounds like we sound a bit weird, you know, we don't generally speak like a lot of the physicians who practice in addiction medicine today. And in fact, you know, we've been told more than once that you guys are kind of weird. You know, I think recovery capital has become hugely important in my office work, in my interaction with patients. It is much more, you know, I ask myself, what is the system doing to increase the recovery capital of this person in front of me? And often it's doing nothing. Mainstream medicine doesn't do that. And then it's up to me, what am I doing in any way to increase someone's recovery capital? And the reality is often some of the best ways to increase recovery capital is through recovery community, just like this community. If recovery is something that is more desirable than just simple sobriety, then I think why we agree we need to look at things in a different way. We talk about wanting to say practicing recovery medicine, and people, you know, look at you as if you've got three eyes. But we search out, we read, we watch, we look for materials, and there are people out there, especially in the US. So it's not surprising that people have asked the question, well, what would it be like if we were sensibly organizing treatment and recovery supports to enhance early engagement of individuals and helping them initiate recovery? And what would it look like to then grow, enhance, maintain that recovery, particularly in regards to personal and family life and all of that kind of, all of those important issues in the long term? And in the US, there certainly is a recovery advocacy movement. It's small, but it's calling for addiction treatment to kind of reconnect it to the longer and more enduring grassroots community based recovery processes. And I think that's the key issue is, you know, there are places that we can help people initiate the recovery, but so what? How can we enhance and make it grow? So out of this has come this term. So we've talked about recovery, recovery of capital, you know, recovery community. But out of this has come writings, especially of White, about recovery-orientated systems of care. And how would one do that? And how would one place emphasis on strength and assets, as described by Paul in recovery capital? And focusing on that kind of emancipation and freedom forward in a new recovery, as opposed to dwelling in the past. What my patients don't need is for me to say, did you drink today? When did you last drink? If you don't drink, you know, if you don't go to meetings, you're going to die. There's also a concept or a growing group of practitioners in recovery coaching, and I've taken some courses in that. And it's really interesting to look at how to coach and move people forward and help them move forward in a very positive way. But this issue of recovery-oriented systems of care would be kind of crazy. It would represent a total fundamental shift away from the crisis-oriented, deficit-focused, professionally directed models of care to a vision of care that's actually directed more by people in recovery, emphasizing and recognizing the reality and the hope for long-term recovery. And as Paul says, there are many paths to recovery. I've spoken at conferences. It's interesting. When you mention the word recovery, and someone, you know, some medical standard would say, oh, you're just from that A&A cult, you know, and they equate recovery with AA or something. But recovery is the journey for me. It's an ongoing journey, and people can get there through AA, secular AA, Smart Recovery, you know, LifeRing, whatever way they want. It is a very different, that old term, the paradigm shift, to move the power differential from medicine and treatment programs and treatment centers to where people in recovery play this important role. And I don't know how far away we are from that, but hopefully we'll see more. And I just thought I'd write down one of the, I think it's White's definition of a recovery-oriented system of care would be a network of homegrown and professional supports designed to initiate, sustain, and enhance the quality of long-term addiction recovery for individuals and families, to create values and policies in the larger cultural and policy environment that are supportive of these recovery processes. And, you know, Is the Canadian healthcare system there? Not even close. But there is hope, because I think many of us are involved without realizing it in what are actually community organizations or entities that are actually kind of mini ROSCs. They're mini recovery oriented assistants of care, and hopefully we can help them grow to provide us some insight on, we did promise we would talk a little bit about the interaction between physicians and their patients and recovery, addiction, and so forth. And you're going to share with us some of your wisdoms about physicians particularly, and trainings and attitudes and things like that.
Yeah, so thank you very much. You know, having worked in a training institution for the last 20 years, I had the opportunity to mentor lots of medical students, residents, addiction fellows, and go through the system myself. And clearly, what is evidence is that any kind of addiction training is minimal within medical training institutions, and it tends to be concentrated very late in training. And because of this, individuals have already developed a bias. Our perspective is based on our perception. And so if the eye of the medical student and resident has always been working in an acute care setting, providing acute care to people, and they're always very sick when they have addiction, you get the impression that these people don't get any better. And that's an especially prevalent attitude among emergency nurses, because they see people at their worst. So they develop a stereotypic view of addiction. Patients aren't committed to recovery. There's no service you can do for them anyway. And they develop this very negative view. And it tends to be very focused on a harm reduction view, because that's where they're engaging people, is when they're experiencing significant harms. And that's an appropriate intervention, is a harm reduction intervention at that point. So it tends to be focused on asking about quantity and frequency and consequences, and using a DSM orientation. It tends to be very protocol driven, with a strong emphasis on the prescription and a pharmacological intervention. So we've got to keep in mind that doctors really tend to see, because they have a selection bias, okay? They don't select, but they work in physical points in the Medicare system, the healthcare system, emergency rooms, offices, et cetera, not doing volunteer work in the community, which selects for patients being at their worst, right? They don't have an understanding of recovery, because people in recovery don't tend to use healthcare too much. They're better. And they generally don't disclose about their history of substance use to their physician, which we'll talk a little bit about. There may also be a narrative against recovery because of the chronic disease model approach. It's a chronic relapsing disease, when there's clear evidence that tells us it's not. That, you know, life and recovery surveys tell us that more than 50% of people achieved a year of sobriety on their first try. But there tends to be a chronic relapse and disease model, I think because of a selection bias and because of the system in which addiction is treated, like Paul discussed. You know, an acute intervention, person goes out, no aftercare, return to substance use, comes back, and, you know, kind of goes around and around until they find a different pathway. So there's a narrative against recovery, I think, that it is rare, it might occur, but the medical system that I work in does not know how to codify, study, elucidate, and develop interventions to assist with it. You got to remember these challenges that physicians have with addiction. They got to be in the back of your head. And I'm going to turn it over to Paul to talk briefly about disclosure, because we're coming up on 38 minutes. Paul's an Irishman. He likes to talk.
No, I just like to make the long story longer. So, yeah, so I really just wanted to make a couple of comments about when you're on the other side of the desk as the patient you know, disclosing. So I guess there's two things. Is it I'm disclosing that I may have problems and my wife is telling me I got to go in and discuss this? Or am I disclosing that, you know what, I've started to go to some meetings, I got some sobriety under my belt, and I'd like my physician to know? And I don't have a clear answer. It's absolutely contextual and who your physician is. But yes, Paul says that too often we assume physicians are going to judge us. But be careful not to overjudge them. You know, be careful in that regard. No doubt it is anxiety provoking. It's interesting that, you know, in AA we have the word anonymous, and it's founded on this foundation of anonymity, which is great because it protects us in meetings and disclosure and we can feel safe. But on the other hand, the emphasis on anonymity kind of contributes to this concept of secrecy and guilt and shame and so forth. And society is similar. You know, we've got people like in Canada, Clara Hughes, big well-known athlete in the United States, Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka, these kind of people coming out about their mental health. But it's different. It's kind of different about addiction, and you have to be kind of brave to come out about that. So at your parent-teacher meeting, you know, while someone stands up and talks about being a breast cancer or a prostate cancer survivor, you know, you might suddenly get quiet when you stand up and talk about being a crack cocaine survivor. So there's no doubt that it's not easy to disclose. You're probably going to have to figure out, you know, your best shot with your own physician. If you're over, you know, if you're really overthinking it, you may say, I don't want this stuff written down, or I'm concerned about my insurance carrier or whatever. And you have to decide all that. But I think at the end of the day, if you are going to disclose something, for me, it's about changing the narrative again from that negative and shame-based story to one of, that's right, yeah, I don't drink alcohol or drugs anymore. I did have a problem with alcohol in the past. I got help and I don't use it anymore. My life is so much better. Thanks for asking. So, I think there is a danger that medics write down something and assume it's all negative, and that you're, you know, white knuckling it, hanging on, that you're going to be drinking the first thing you leave the office. But I think this more positive narrative of I did have a problem in the past. I got help. I don't use it anymore. My life is so much better. Thanks for asking. And then what do? You may get a physician asking you, well, how did you do that? What kind of help did you get? And some physicians will want some assistance from their patients. And again, you have to figure out where they are at. But often in a town or community, people know that there is one physician who has an interest for whatever reason and is generous to people with addiction. Other physicians, not many, but I've heard, will acknowledge, or someone will say, my abstinence, my sobriety date is whatever in April 2009. It was a life-changing event. It's an important day for me because my healthy recovery journey began at that time. But disclosure, it's a very personal thing. I think one has to decide. I think it probably depends on many things, your relationship with the physician, the length of time, how comfortable you are. But it's interesting that many people don't disclose. So, Paul, back to you.
So the doctor says, characteristically, you don't drink, do you? And my response, which is much my original treating physician, said, no, but I had a real serious problem. I got some help and my life is a lot better. Thanks for asking. And it behooves that physician then, possibly a bias, to ask, how do you do that? And then it opens the door to a bit of a discussion. So I'm going to talk a little bit more of what to be aware of when you're speaking to your physician. Be aware of the power imbalance, okay? In a doctor-patient relationship, there is a significant power imbalance. Like when I go to my doctor, I don't feel comfortable. When you go to your doctor, you probably feel the same way I do, nervous. But when I'm the doctor, I feel like I'm in control, right? I'm controlling the flow of patients. This is my office. Things are done my way. I'm in my comfort zone and I'm busy. And I feel uncomfortable when I get into uncharted territories. When I get tossed a curveball, that makes me uncomfortable and I got to figure out a way of dealing with it. So I would suggest consider a responsive approach as opposed to an overt approach. Not, doctor, I got something to tell you, but when the opportunity turns up, say, thanks for asking. And very brief, and very short script to say, yeah, I'm one of those individuals, the majority of actually, that overcame and achieved remission, but not only remission, recovery. I think we also got to keep in mind that it's in the chart. And doing a lot of occupational addiction medicine, I review a lot of charts and a lot of medical documents. So it's in the chart. And how is it documented? And commonly, it's just documented alcoholic. But it doesn't say anything about long-term stable remission, fulminant recovery, right? So if that's going to be documented, can you make a note of my date of abstinence? Because the five-year point is very important from an insurance standpoint. Consider how that information is shared. What kind of consents have you provided in regard to insurance, workplace, or other information sharing? And it's a catch-22. It really is a catch-22. We believe in celebrating recovery. I believe in celebrating my recovery. May 13, 1993, when my wife forgets it, I guilt her. And I go buy a snowmobile. But the second piece is that, you know, how widely am I confident about disclosing that? The last piece is consider your healthcare professional, whether physician, nurse practitioner, et cetera, may have family experience with addiction. This may produce a positive light. You know, my sister had addiction. She got into recovery. I know this is possible. Or it may produce a negative light where the physician's parent was dependent on substances and largely abstinent or abusive. And there may be some resentment. So it may result in the individual being clearly helpful or maybe result in possibly some resentments. So keep those points in mind. Paul, you're going to finish it off?
Okay. Yeah, I think the only other thing I really, I guess, wanted to add was I think if you get a physician who appears to be interested in addiction and and remission, and one just needs to be careful, I would respectfully suggest, about how much you might take on. Is, you know, one of the, I think the things for me or for many of us, I think, is, you know, we don't do boundaries well and we get to do it better with recovery. But will you meet this patient of mine, or kind of will you take over this patient? Will you be supportive? Now, will you be his sponsor or her sponsor? You know, I think we have to be very clear. I think it's useful in recovery, if we believe in being a good citizen and then and contributing, and that's part of our recovery, there might be a time to discuss with your physician that you would be willing to assist in some way. So when I was a family doctor way back in North Central British Columbia, I had an AA member who came in regularly and filled all the, you know, all beside the screening tests for blood pressure and all those pamphlets. He filled those things all the time. Actually, they were the pamphlets that disappeared quicker than anything else, to tell you the truth. But, you know, what might you offer a physician? I think just being careful about boundaries. I've had situations where someone says to me, you know, you're probably, or I'm probably the first paramedic you've ever seen with addiction. And you think, you know, that's kind of part of our regular work. You know, is there someone else, you know, that I might be able to speak to or relate to about licensure or about work or whatever? And occasionally I would, you know, speak to both parties and see were they comfortable coming together and respecting anonymity and understanding those responsibilities. So going back to the key issue is, I think we probably should be willing to try and help physicians, but I think you have to define boundaries about what is appropriate or what are you willing to do. But if I think the other thing is, if you've got a physician in your community who appears to be interested, is trying to introduce him or her to your recovery community, showing him that, you know, people can dress up and show up, you know, as good as all the people on this screen because of a life of recovery. So I think I'll just leave it at that. And if that's okay, Joe, we'll go to some questions. And, you know, so the doctor's opinion, you know, we got two guys that are considered to be a bit wacko at times, but that's fine. Anyway, there you go.
Thank you both so much, Paul S. and Paul F. We've got about 5 minutes now, everybody, if for one or two questions or comments, if you want to put your hands up.
I'm Janice. I'm an alcoholic. I just wanted to say that when I walked in the door of my first AA meeting, I'd already done the first step. And when I walked in the door of my doctor's office the next week, I had a female physician who was really great. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. I've gone to AA. Is there anything else? And she sent me to an addiction specialist. It was a good thing AA worked, because my insurance would cover 9 visits in a year. And one was an hour visit, and the others were supposed to be medication adjusted visits. And he stretched it. He was he was really good. I liked him, but it was AA that worked for me. And so I try very hard to do service work, particularly doing a shift in central office, so I can talk to people. You know, and every doctor I have knows. I recently broke my hip. Okay. We're looking at having narcotics, which has never been part of my addiction history. I don't have any problem with taking them and putting them down. But I made sure my surgeon knew. I made sure the paramedics took me into the hospital knew. I made sure my surgeon knew. And for me, that's important, because how can anybody help you with certain things if they don't know? Particularly for people who have trouble with opiates, their doctor certainly needs to know not to put them on them, you know. And but it was great. You're just wonderful, and that's all I've got.
Yeah, I can respond to that too, and thank you very much. That was my experience too. My experience was, you know, the acronym CHIME. I remember the first meeting I walked into, and I sat down and a physician took me there, and I sat down next to a nurse. And what she said to me just gave me, you know, just connected me. Next thing, I was feeling hope, and I was feeling identity. I was feeling a member of that recovering community after a few weeks. And it wasn't long. I was about 3 or 4 months. I was developing new meaning. Yeah, and so those are my experience. I mean, I had a treating physician for quite a long period of time that I had to go see him, but that really was the contingency piece, right? That, you know, that was my license. This was the guy who's going to advocate for me going back to work as a physician after, you know, about 4 months of being off. But the real recovery piece came from the recovering community.
Thanks. Thank you, Janice and Paul, for your answer. Jenny, do you want to come in now?
Hi, yeah, I'm Jenny. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for the meeting, Karen, and I think it's Joe and Paul. And Paul, thank you. I didn't really have a question, just a comment. I just think that was absolutely amazing, and I got so much from that. And that recovery capital thing, it's like what some friends have said to me, but when you hear it worded in that way, and I don't think you're weird, I think he's bloody brilliant. And I think it's a shame we don't have more doctors with your attitudes, because I think life would be a lot easier. It was just fantastic, like everything you said. It was just brilliant. AA is important, but as people always advise me, you know, it's important to get, like, it's a whole holistic approach, isn't it? It's no good making meetings your new addiction type thing. It's doing the meetings, finding your community, and like getting outside help and things like that. And what you said about the anonymity thing, that's something I feel really strongly about, because half the time I know why we have it. But half the time, I think it'd do the whole wider community. I know it sounds very simplistic. Sometimes I think maybe it's time to drop it. Because like you said, we're keeping it in the, you know, because sometimes I feel, oh, I better not say, because they might think that and that. And really, by saying it, and, you know, now I have changed a bit. I'm only early, but I was ashamed. But now I'm quite proud of what I'm doing, because I'm achieving a lot. And by saying that, if someone else hears you, it might give them the catalyst to do something. So I just think everything you said was just so helpful, so positive, and yeah, took a lot from it both. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Jenny. I would add, if I may, you know, Paul and I talk about this, but Joe referenced Dr. Ray Baker, who was my office partner. You know, he's been a leader in Canada, but gee, time, you know, change takes time. And I think Paul and I would like to think we can influence stuff, but man, it's slow, or if at all. I think this recovery community, everyone on this call, I would suggest to you, has a role to play in helping to enlighten people about recovery. It's more than remission. It's more than sobriety. What it is, I think that's really important. And one more point, as Paul said, just be kind to that situation when you know the way your physician behaving means that him or her really should be in this program. You know, someone may come across that, and it's egos are hard, and it's embarrassing, and it's shameful, and we're a bad person, and so that's another situation where you may want to put your thinking hat on about what you would do if you know that your own physician actually would benefit from being on the screen today.
Great, thanks so much, Paul F and Paul S and Jenny. Thanks for your comments too. Anyway, that's the end of the session. Thank you, everyone, for joining. And can everyone unmute and thank both the Pauls for coming along?
Well, thank you. That was amazing.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Amazing.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the invite.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, we're all out of the closet then, okay?
Yeah.
Great presentation. Great.
Excellent.
Take it on any new patients?
All of that stuff on recovery medicine is just so cool. And assets-based and strengths-based, it's just amazing. I loved it all. Thank you.
Thank you.